a mini-zode.
What's a mini-zode?
This is a mini-zode.
Mini-zode?
Yes.
I see.
Sorry, are we quibbling over pronunciation now?
Yeah.
Mini-zode.
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 Like episode? Mini-zode.
Episode.
Who says episode?
I do. What's wrong with that?
Okay, episode then. As you want. Welcome to this mini-zode of Talk Cardboard, a podcast about board games and everything adjacent with me, Elaine, and you.
Mini Efka.
On today's episode, we'll be escaping a citadel only to find the outside is even worse in the Seventh Citadel and luring dragons into our lair to steal their eggs in Wormspan. That's just a Wormspan, right?
I just want to say, I wasn't wheezing. That was the dog near the microphone going, as she does sometimes.
First, though, we've had an email from John. They say, when Efka brought up Mystic Vale, he mentioned that he found it dull and uninteresting. Knee-jerk reaction, hey, I like Mystic Vale, it's pretty cool. Followed by, oh, but I played it when it came out. Would it be a recommendation now? It might be obvious to you both, but it finally hit me that new recommendations are useless if the game no longer has the chops to be considered. Would I recommend anyone else to pick up a physical copy of Mystic Vale today or in the future? Not really. There are a lot of deck building games out there that are easier to deal with than card crafting and have a lot more interesting choices. And if you want to play a press your luck game, there are a lot more games that do it better. So thank you for giving a perspective on games for now instead of on past thoughts.
Wow, I feel vindicated somehow. I don't know. Like, I know Mystic Vale has a lot of fans. Mm. And I just always thought that it was a little bit maybe, you know, sparkle in the eyes because of the gimmick. it was quite novel, you know?
Sure,
or at least it seemed novel, I think. And yeah, I think time is showing that Mystic Vale maybe wasn't all it was cracked up to be.
If you have anything to say about this episode or previous episodes, let us know. Elaine@nopunincluded.com.
I will be writing in.
About what?
One of the hosts picking on pronunciation.
I look forward to reading it. This next segment talks about the Seventh Citadel, which contains depictions of slavery within a fantasy setting. Let's move on to our first game, which is The Seventh Citadel, which comes from publisher Serious Pulp by designers Ludovic Rudy and Bruno Salter, with art by Ludovic Rudy.
I like how you pronounce Pulp.
Well, it's spelled P-O-U-L-P.
Yeah, it Pulp. Is.
Please tell us about the game.
Oh, well, okay, so this is just first impressions. I don't want to give anyone like kind of a sense that we've played this so much that we know it inside out or whatever. So we spend a good like 5 hours with it. And we spent those 5 hours on just the introduction of the game, which tells you how long the introduction to the game is. So if you're not familiar with Seventh Citadel, it is the sequel to Seventh Continent, which is a game that came out all the way back in 2017, and we have reviewed in the past. It has become somewhat of an audience darling, albeit not a critical darling, and I think there are good reasons for that. We were one of the critics that definitely did not gel with Seventh Continent, and we featured it twice in our videos, once in our review of Seventh Continent, which is quite old, and once in our retrospective of Choose Your Own Adventure Genre Board Gamified, which is a video about Sleeping Gods and Seventh Continent and Tainted Grail, and how those emerged from Choose Your Own Adventure, like style books, like Fighting Fantasy, and how that itself was informed by the works of Gary Gygax. The less said about Gary, the better. So, Seventh Citadel is maybe, perhaps somewhat ironically, released 7 years later as a follow-up to a groundbreaking game in many ways, because it established this new genre that you can have this sort of choose your own adventure, but the board gamified part not only adds a complex rule set to how you proceed, but also introduces the concept of a map that is composed out of many, many cards that form like a picture of a terrain, and it is gamified as well. You can interact with these cards. They have various numbers. They pull out other cards. They might be events or gear or puzzles or what have you. So it gives you this sort of sense of a growing landscape. Seven Citadel advances that by also introducing concepts of building your base somewhere where you can retreat to. And instead of just being one long, never-ending adventure that you kind of discover in multiple parts, I guess, as you traverse through the terrain and, you know, find out more of the map and whatnot. Now you have a segmented adventure where each, I don't want to say session, because I think these segments can be quite long.
And I think you can split them up, can't you?
Yeah, I think you're definitely allowed to just pause the game whenever you want and say, we're just putting a stop on it now. So there is a nevertheless this segmentation that says basically you're trying to achieve like a smaller thing within the scope of a grander adventure. The box comes with two adventures plus the introductory scenario, and because this is a crowdfunded project, obviously extra adventures as expansion packs and mini expansions that add variety to the events and all kinds of little things. I was looking forward to Seven Citadel because, again, 7 years between the releases, you know, hopefully there's some advancement. Hopefully there's something, you know, that really kind of iterates on the formula and the issues that the old game presented. I think a lot of people eventually stopped gelling with the game because it's so expansive in scope, and yet you are forced to like start this adventure from the beginning and then play, sometimes for 10s and 20 hours, you know, and then, I've lost. Okay, I have to restart the whole thing from the beginning. And I think that is a major problem, right? And one that I don't think the designers have accounted for. Originally, they just thought, oh, we'll bring choose your own adventure books, but like board gamified. Okay, but what happens when you do that? You know, a book, when you're reading a choose your own adventure book and it says you died, you're not going to flip to passage one and start the whole thing from the beginning.
No.
Because you've already read that. You don't want to read that again. You just want to have the adventure. So you'll just thumb back and
to
go
where you went wrong.
Yeah. Like, and you're going to cheat, right? Like, let's face it, people cheat when they do this, right? It's inevitable.
Well, because the idea is that you're having a nice time, not that you're punishing yourself by having to read the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, right? So, but when you introduce this, like, really expansive rule set to it all, when you codify it in card draws and dice rolls and, you know, like, various systems, cheating doesn't feel so natural anymore. And it's weird to say that cheating should feel natural, but within this genre, I think it should. Because the alternative is that you have to restart and go over and over. The same plot beats, the same events, the same locations, the same characters, everything. Whew, I wouldn't want to do that, right?
So how has this changed in Seventh Citadel then?
Well, okay, so I'm not like a big expert on the game yet because, like I said, we've only spent about 5 hours with it and we played through the introduction and I wanted to give my impressions on that. I think we'll return to some more coverage of Seven Citadel as we go along in video form. But one thing that's important to note is that whilst there is a system that says, you know, hey, like this is segmented, right? So that's good, right? But there is also that 5 hour introduction. Now, guess if you have to replay the 5 hour introduction if you lose the campaign.
Why would you?
I don't know. Like, you've done it and it's not that interesting. It feels like extended setup, doesn't it?
The thing is, I can understand if there are multiple branching paths. So if you were to restart, you might end up doing something different or discovering something else. But with the introductory scenario, I do feel like we covered everything.
Not everything. So there were some plot beats that you kind of can go yay or nay. And we went yay and nay on some of them. And you could vary that up, right? But I don't want that to take 5 hours. I want yes or no questions next time I do it, right? Like, hey, you know, if this, then that. You know, if this, then that. If this, then that. takes 10 minutes, extended setup done, right? Not 5 hours again.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. Like, I don't feel like there was enough that would have changed if we played it again. You're right. There were like small bits that we kind of do this or this. Okay, I'll do this. That you might do differently. But yeah, if the book just had, you've done this before. Like if you've already read this, skip to this part and yes or no.
Now, okay. So once again, we've only, you know, dabbled with the system. Maybe there is something that we are just missing for now that completely subverts that.
I hope so.
But so there were a couple of criticisms that we've had of Seven Continent that I also want to touch on, apart from the whole, like, this is silly to restart this, you know? One of my main bugbears with this idea of board gamifying choose-your-own-adventure, you know, books, is that a lot of advancement in tabletop storytelling has happened over the decades that we've seen the introduction of, you know, Fighting Fantasy and the Lone Wolf series and all of that. And one of the main concepts that has been drilled into me decades ago now, even when I was starting out in role-playing, you know, was the idea of failing forward. That failure, binary failure especially, isn't that interesting, you know? And it doesn't feel rewarding. It doesn't progress the story in interesting ways. You know, it just doesn't do much. And I wanted to see that sort of implementation in these board gamified versions, this idea that, you know, okay, so you made a choice and that choice maybe, you know, however you codify it, you know, could have been bad or something, right? But make it more interesting than you were wrong. It's not that you were wrong and oops, you lose. It's, hey, you've made a decision that has consequences. These are the consequences. And it's much more interesting that if they are narrative consequences, right, that they propel the story in a different direction rather than they are punitive and say, oh, oops, you lost like 5 hit points or whatever. Bad, right? You know, I wanted to see more of that, and I wanted to see less of the rug pull, because the rug pull, again, is not very interesting. And it's very Gygaxian in that way. It's that idea that, you know, you know, here's two choices. You don't really know which of them is good or bad, but pick randomly. But that's, you know,
the thing. One of them shouldn't be bad and one good. Like, they should just take you in different directions.
Exactly, right? So I wanted to see more of that. I haven't seen much evidence of this ethos in Seven Citadel. And in fact, this brings me on to the last bit of the sort of broader critique of the whole concept. Now that there is a sort of bigger narrative scope, there is also a lot more narrative than Seventh Continent. Seventh Citadel has a dialogue book. And that's, you know, sometimes prompts will take you to the dialogue book and you'll start like reading a conversation that you are having with a character or whatever, and then you'll have choices you could make, you know. And that's just one element of how narrative is introduced. There's also a threat book. So the threat is the scenario. And you will start the scenario by reading the threat book. It will set up the world and, you know, what's going on, the sort of plot beats. And I don't know if I'm a big fan of the narrative that the designers of Seven Continent and now Seven Citadel have deployed here. It's not that it's poorly written, but I don't think writing is their strong suit, right? It's also this. I'm just not a fan of the vibe that they are trying to create.
I don't know what kind of vibe they're trying to create. Some of the language in it, I thought, this is quite out of place. It's words that I wouldn't have necessarily chosen myself.
Right. Okay. So when you start Seven Citadel, there is a lot of capital letter nouns thrown at you. World building happens at the pace of Galadriel's introduction in the Lord of the Ring films, you know, when she sets up the world, but like 3 times that, right? You know, because she's quite, you know, methodical, but she goes you know, Sauron, Saruman, Gandalf, you know, Isildur, everyone, you know, well, she didn't mention Gandalf, but hey, never mind, you get the idea, right? Isildur, you know,
there's a lot of
Sauron
names, yeah.
Fighting, Gondor, you know, you're like, okay, what are all these things, right? But the film does it elegantly and sets it up. Here, this is like, oh, there's necro-druids and Kel and, you know, all kinds of things. And you're going, oh, okay, oh, what? Sorry, what's happening, right? There's a lot of that. So it's not elegant. It's just info dumped onto you.
Which is a little weird, I thought, because if we are playing the characters that live in this world, we would know what these things were. To have all this information come at once seems... It takes you out of being that character, being in the game.
I know, right? So, and on top of that, then you learn kind of your place within this world, which is that you were captured, imprisoned, tortured, and your official title term is Slave Gardener. I think it was an interesting choice to use a term that is very fraught. I'm not saying that you can't tell a story in tabletop about, you know, issues concerning slavery or whatever. And I do recognize that this is a fantasy setting. Please, no one needs to explain that to me, okay? But it's still a choice, right? It's still a choice to use that term. And I hope the designers know that the term is loaded and has a lot of connotations and shouldn't be deployed lightly. Now, I've seen no evidence of any kind of nuance there, nuance or commentary or something that alludes to subversions of just basic fantasy tropes and the sort of grim, dark, very, very heavy metal tropes, you know. I've also the first thing that happens. So this isn't really a spoiler, but because this is the first thing that happens. The first sort of plot beat you get is damsel in distress. And so this damsel in distress story does resolve by the time you finish the introduction. And then I was just sitting there going, well, I hope they subvert this, right? And for the interest of not spoiling things, I will not say whether it does or doesn't. But my disappointed tone of voice should... maybe give something away here.
Yeah, when we read that last part of the story, we were like, okay, I'm ready for this to do something. And then we were like, okay, we've read the story now.
Yeah, I wasn't jazzed by how any of that played out. It's also quite grim. It's quite grim. There's a lot of bodily harm and death.
Oh, and it's depicted on the cards too.
Yeah.
It's not just described, there are pictures of it. There's nothing super gory.
No, yeah.
But it's a little bit shocking, I thought.
I mean, again, this is fine, but like in comparison to Seven Citadel, I just didn't know. I don't know if people are expecting that, you know? Because you certainly... Not that Seven Continents shied away from that kind of stuff, but here it's very explicit and very in your face, and there's just a lot more of it. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, like a heavy metal vibe or whatever, but I feel like it's deployed very casually, you know, and it's not really, it doesn't have the, you know, like when you play games that are deliberately gory, they sometimes have a bit of panache and attitude and style and... you know, verve. And I didn't find any of that verve here. I found more of the mundanity of trad kind of fantasy stuff that didn't make me fall in love with the setting.
I didn't hate the setting. I don't think I cottoned on to the fact it was this kind of damsel in distress till right at the end.
And well, I mean, that's just the plot beat. That's not the whole plot or anything.
No. But you picked up on it much sooner. Because I think I'm so primed not to see that anymore, to be like, that can't be the story. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the game that we played, the way that it worked was that one player ended up being slightly more disadvantaged than the other. because of this.
Because they're dealing with a damsel in distress.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was just how we played or if that's the way it's designed, but it wasn't that much fun to be like, well, I can't really do anything because this, this and this. So if you do this now, and then you did this now, so you managed to advance in the story more than I did.
Well, okay, so I guess this brings us onto the mechanisms, right? Mm. So the basic mechanical concept of Seven Citadel is that each player has an action deck of cards. Now, whenever you are posed with any kind of challenge, right, you will be allowed to draw X number of cards and you'll need to get Y number of successes. So when you draw these cards, a card might have none success, half a success, or full success in the shape of a star. When it's half of a success, the orientation of the star matters as well, because if you can put two together, that counts as one success. But they need to align, yes, as in, because so if you have two left stars, they don't make a success. Right. You need a left and a right. This action deck, that's initially composed out of 20 cards, but it grows and it can be modified, is then also your kind of life force, because you have... you're given a number of like life points at the beginning of the scenario that depends entirely on like player count and what the scenario says. And so when your deck runs out of cards, you're forced to reshuffle your discard. It's your choice how many cards from the discard you reshuffle back into the deck. But for every two cards you shuffle back in, you have to lose a life point. Now, there's also a story mode, which lets you do three cards per life point, and there's some sort of a hardcore mode as well, I think, which is nice. I like that there's variability, and for people who are not too into the rules nitty-gritty and want to just explore the world, there is that option that says, hey, this is just a little bit easier, you know? So that's nice. I like that. The other thing about these cards is that it's your choice often. Often it's your choice how many of them you draw. And sometimes some of the ones you draw, you will even get to keep in your hand. And when they're in your hand, each card has a different special ability that lets you manipulate these tests in varied and multiple ways. On top of that, you also have items that lets you manipulate these tests. For example, it'll let you draw less cards. If a test, for example, says you have to draw five cards, but you only need one success. And you're like, well, I could probably get away with just three cards, and you might have an item that reduces that number, and you're like, okay, now I'm using less cards to pass this, you know, test or whatever, and so on and so on, right? There's a lot of systems that interact with it that are not immediately evident from just reading the rulebook, because the way Seventh Citadel is constructed, and this is its big strength, I think, is that every rule that exists within this game, or every rule interaction that is crafted through these multitudes and multitudes of different actions available on the cards in your hand, or the cards you draw from your deck, or the item cards, or things that you find, they're created in a simulationist way to evoke that the rules represent, via mechanisms, what you do fictionally. Does that make sense? So I think this is probably Seven Citadel's biggest strength, but also at the same time its biggest weakness, because it all depends on how much you gel with that simulationism, you know? Because whilst it enacts really well, it gives you this sort of sense that these cards really transform the rules into what you're doing. It almost embodies you within this world. But at the same time, they are a big faff. They're just a big faff. And your tolerance for faff, you know, is the prime decider whether you're going to enjoy this or just hate it. That was a lot of rules. But now we can give context to why that whole damsel in distress thing was kind of clunky rules-wise for us. You were inconvenienced. Your character was inconvenienced by this, and because of that, you had to lose extra cards every time you moved. And as you move through this scenario, right, there's many little side places you can explore as you're going down the main path. Now, the side places I got to explore, and you got to wait in the main corridor, because going into the side...
It was too punishing, to go in and out of rooms, because I would have spent too many cards doing it, and not knowing what was in those rooms, and not knowing how the damsel on my shoulder would affect what was happening in those rooms. It just wasn't worth me going in there and then having to come back out and do all of that business. So, yeah, but I do think that was maybe just how we played it, because I could have done those things.
And we probably would have lost, because...
Well, yeah, because yeah. I ended on not super high life. So because we did end up having to take cards back, which meant we had to lose life, because that's how that works. But we did manage to finish the scenario with some health still intact.
The rules of the game motivated you to do something that was sensible mechanically, but uninteresting and unrewarding narratively.
Maybe, yeah, I think so. But what was interesting and rewarding narratively was still going from not knowing what the next thing was and being able to choose what room you wanted to have a look in, or what you wanted to do, or where you wanted to go next, and seeing what was on that next tile and trying to maybe interact with that or not, if you didn't have to immediately, and leaving it to, you know, to, okay, we'll come back to this later on when, you know, maybe when we're a bit more ready for it. And that, I mean, you know, turning over tiles and discovering new things is always a fun thing, even if it's a bad thing. You're like, oh, what? I'm just going to have a look, just see what this is. So that was fun. I didn't hate the setting. I thought it was a well put together introductory scenario. Okay, it made sense. This is what you're doing. This is why you're doing it. Okay, this is your goal.
Yeah. Right?
So that all made sense to me.
I think you should have had a content warning. Honestly, I think I would have been fine with that setting, as long as they said, this is what we're doing. Be aware of it, you know, up front, right? Like, because people, you know, they need to know when they go into these sorts of things, like what to expect, right? No one wants to be battered over the head with things that they kind of don't want to deal with, right? Mm. And I don't know. I feel like that sort of attitude where you just go, well, no, just it's a surprise. And
it feels very flippant.
You'll see, you know. No, don't impose that stuff on people who just don't want it, you know?
But having said that, the subtitle, the description of the game provided by the publisher on Board Game Geek tells you that immediately. Mm. So I don't think you would go into this game having absolutely no idea what was in store. Do you understand? That makes sense.
I guess so. You know, not everyone visits Board Game Geek. I don't know.
Why don't they? It's the primary resource for board games.
Well, you know...
But anyway, the art I appreciated. I know I said some of it was like a little bit shocking because I wasn't expecting it.
Mm.
But the art was good. I liked it. It made sense as well. Like, everything was clear what it meant, what it wanted you to do, what it needed you to achieve, like the number of successes or whatever. You know, that was all clear. The iconography was clear. Once you'd learn what it meant.
Once you learn that what it's trying to do, because when I read the rule book, I was like, oh, okay, there's not that many rules. This seems, and I don't understand how they all gel together. And it's once you realize that every interaction, it probably has a new rule that it explores, because it's trying to evoke, you know, the narrative via the rules system. It's trying to simulate it. Once I got that through, I started to understand that I don't need to know the rules. I need to interpret the rules, right? And which is a big ask, I think, because with a Choose Your Own Adventure book, it's like, I just need to know how to read in the language that the book is written, right? Mm-hmm. That's all I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I can play this game. Here, I need to be a seventh Citadel Mancer.
I mean, that's not quite true about those books, because sometimes they have like clues, don't they, in the paragraph as to where it's trying to get you to go to.
Sure, but that's not a rule set. That's just like.
No, but you said all you need to know to be able to do is read. That's not. You need to know how to interpret. And that's what you're talking about, interpreting.
I disagree. There's a whole extra layer here is very different.
I agree. Well, I don't know because I didn't read the rule book. So and in fact, you said to me, I'm not going to really teach all the rules. We'll learn as we go.
Well, I did say that, yeah, because I taught you how to take a basic action, right? And I didn't think I needed to teach more. As long as I have read the rule book and watched some videos and, you know, done all that jazz, because it's one of those games that can have a flowing teach. You don't need to teach people how to play it before you play. As long as one person knows, they can go, when you encounter something, you can go, oh, okay, this is how that works. And you go, oh, okay, and you keep going.
And I don't think that slowed the game down particularly.
No.
No, I think that worked all right. I think you did well.
No. So I'm looking forward to exploring more of it. I'm looking forward to see how our concerns are alleviated or expounded. I don't know. We'll find out. There is the whole Citadel business, because now you also get to do some base building and leveling up and all of that. And we've just dipped into that at the end of the introduction.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
That was something new and different and from Seventh Continent. And I'm looking forward to exploring that more. And it definitely does feel like you're entering a little town or a village.
Well, no, you're founding it. It's your little town or village.
Yeah. To build this and see what happens and see what you can do with this.
Do we have any emails?
We do, funnily enough. We have an email from Eric. They say, in an episode a whole back, you mentioned wanting board game fan fiction or fiction and had a discussion about books set in the worlds of board games not really being a thing. That's largely true. However, I do have a Galaxy Trucker book, fiction in the setting of board game Galaxy Trucker, about a very Galaxy Trucker journey delivering sewer pipes. I realise one book doesn't count for much, but it is a surprising artifact that I thought you might find interesting. And they put pictures in the email of the back and the front of the book.
It's a published book.
It's a published book.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible.
I know.
I didn't know there was a Galaxy Trucker book.
No, neither did I.
Is it available?
I didn't look to see whether it's available.
Oh, Elaine.
It's probably you could probably find it on Abe Books or somewhere like that, right?
All right. Was it in English?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I managed to read the back of it, so I assume so.
I'm only asking because, you know, the publisher and designer of Galaxy Trucker, they're Czech. Mm. So I was wondering if the book was also Czech. But if it's in English. Okay, cool.
So thank you for sharing that with us, Eric. That's very exciting.
Oh, do you know what I just remembered? What? There were Arkham Horror books, weren't there? I remember them existing, yeah. Oh, and Netrunner books. Well, there you go. There's more. There's more out there.
Netrunner, Arkham Horror.
Yeah, there's definitely Magic the Gathering novels.
Yeah.
Does that count as a board game?
Yeah, well, a tabletop game, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, RPGs have many fictional books written for them.
Yes.
I remember trying to read Vampire the Masquerade novels and just thinking, wow, I'm young, but this is bad. I'm young and I've not read many books, but this is bad.
I wasn't young when I read the Gamma World novel, but I thought this doesn't feel like Gamma World at all.
Yeah.
But I loved that game. And it just didn't, it did not put me in the world of Gamma World at all. But if you know any other board game fiction that I don't know about, please let me know, elaine@nopunincluded.com.
And you will read all of them.
I'll try. Our next game is Wormspan, which comes from publisher Stonemaier Games by designer Connie Vogelman with art by Clémentine Campardou.
Is this a game about how long a worm is?
No, but tell me more.
You know, those wriggly things.
I know what a worm is. Yeah. You know, there are so many different types of worms.
They have different spans, don't they?
I see. So it's a game about measuring worms.
About measuring your worm. That face.
We've got some baby worms in the garden. I've seen them.
Deflecting the conversation,
anyway, this is not about earthworms or garden worms. This is about worms with a W. Oh, no, with a W. With a Y, W-Y-R-M-S, like tiny dragons.
And it is the sequel to Wingspan.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is, though. It is. It's the same publisher. It's the same base game. The same rule set, almost. But now with dragons. We're one of the... I mean, I remember reviewing Wingspan. Mm. And I remember being very excited about the birds and everything.
And the menu.
Yeah, and the menu. And then I remember playing it and going, oh, this is, you know, not... It's not bad. This isn't bad. It's just not wowing me, you know? And I remember after our review came out, saying in the newsletter that, like, I just don't even think it's that great of an intro game because, you know, what about this Uwe Rosenberg farming game that I can't even remember the name of, right? Because that game that I said, this is probably a better intro game to people who want, like, a nature theme, you know, board game, right? I can't even remember the name of it. Do I remember the name of Wingspan? Yes, because subsequently it has went completely gangbusters everywhere. Everyone knows Wingspan, right? People who don't know about board games know about Wingspan. It's what was it? Was it in like EastEnders or
oh, I don't know. Was
or
it?
Some
was what, it in the telly show?
Coronation Street or something like that? It was in one of those British soaps. They were playing Wingspan or something like that.
Oh, there's a few Hollyoaks.
Yeah, one of those.
EastEnders.
Wow. Yeah, or yeah. I think maybe it was
Brookside.
EastEnders. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they were playing it in the
yeah.
It wasn't just in on the
no.
Background.
Yeah, they were actually playing it.
Okay,
yeah,
that's cool.
That is kind of something, right? Yeah. So yeah, like I said, Wingspan a. Phenomenon, right? How do you follow a phenomenon, right?
With dragons.
I guess with dragons. I think there's a conscious knowledge here that you cannot beat the success of Wingspan. Mm. Wingspan will always be Wingspan. So any other product in that line is just going to be like an additional product rather than like, well, hey, this game's going to be even bigger than Wingspan. I don't think anything can be that.
Mm.
So there's I think an inbuilt knowledge, and maybe because of that, the theme is a lot stranger and more esoteric, you know, instead of like something that makes sense on a kind of surface level, you are observing birds, you know, and you're putting birds in your portfolio, right? Mm-hmm. That you've observed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. It makes sense. Right. You are now excavating caves to... Mm. Populate them with dragons. So we went from real world to fantasy. But bizarrely, there's a book in the game that acts as a kind of like one of those like nature guides, I guess, on animals, you know, where it like gives you factoids about all the different dragons that are in the game. And the factoids are obviously completely made up.
Yes, in fact, when we opened the box, I picked out the booklet, went, oh, there's a booklet here. And then went, oh, yeah, they're not real. Dragons
yeah,
aren't real.
Your face. Oh, my, what?
It was a roller coaster of emotions.
It was so weird.
But then.
What, no, sorry. No, we're going to expound on this because you lit up. Your eyes went big. It's like, oh, I can learn about all these dragons. And you went, wait a minute, they're not real. Fuck. Just chuck the book across the room.
But actually, it was really nice to learn about them. We read out all the descriptions of all the dragons as we played the game.
Well, no, only because I forced you to. Midway through the game, you stopped doing it. You were like, I'm...
Because I got into the game more. That was the only reason. Because I was concentrating on the dragons that I need. Actually, no, that's the opposite. I stopped concentrating on what dragon it was and started concentrating on...
The mechanical effects.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the mechanical effects. So I'm not going to rehash the rules of Wingspan. I think most people are familiar with it. If you're not, the idea, it's a tableau builder, right? You have a huge stack of cards. You will try and get some of these cards and you're going to play them into your tableau, into three different rows. And then sometimes you will trigger these rows and resolve every card in sequence. And hopefully the card effects will have combinations with one another that will, give you more things, points, resources, that kind of jazz.
Yeah,
right?
You made that sound very dry. You're excavating caves, you're exploring caves, you're enticing dragons, you're stealing their eggs to do things.
You're playing cards.
You're playing cards.
Right. Well, no, I just wanted to give a brief overview what Wingspan is.
I know.
So, you know, I can give context for Wormspan. So the big changes. Okay, so there's a few, right? So first of all, you cannot just play a card anymore. Before, you were able to pick a row, leftmost empty slot, put a card in there, you pay the resources, what the card cost, done, right? Now you need to first play a cave card into there. And then playing cave cards also carries restrictions, because the further you excavate the cave, the more eggs you need to pay, which thematically doesn't make any sense.
No, I was thinking about this. It does, because you eat them. Like, you need energy to excavate.
But won't the dragons that live in the cave get upset that you eat the eggs?
I thought that. But maybe that's just the penalty for living in your safe.
This is becoming very exploitative. Anyway.
Like, if you're going to keep chickens, you're going to eat their eggs, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. But are the dragons chickens? Because they're not. They seem quite intelligent, you know?
The question of the podcast, are dragons chickens?
Well, no, the question is, are dragons sapient, you know, within the setting of Wormspan?
Do you mean sentient?
Well, you know, like Homo sapiens.
Yeah, wise man.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh. Wise dragon. Draco sapiens.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Your face. Can I just? I knew as soon as I said that, I opened a can of worms.
Do you know why? Because this game made me cry.
Oh, this game did make you cry.
Yeah, genuinely made me cry.
I had to console you. Yeah.
And also tell me, Elaine, it's enough, really.
Well, there was. I mean, you engineered that yourself, because you reminded yourself of Puff the Magic Dragon, which for some reason makes you cry. I've learned this over the years.
Yes. And let's not talk about it now.
Oh, no.
Please.
Oh, no.
I understand that you needed to say that, but let's move on.
Okay, yeah, for the sake of everyone involved.
The dragons, I don't think, mind you taking their eggs. I think they're okay with it. I'm going to see it like that.
We're gonna codify that right now so that we can move on, right?
A safe home.
Okay.
You are giving them a nice place to live. And as payment, they are giving you a few of their eggs.
Unborn children.
Well, not necessarily, but it's like chickens. You know, chickens will lay an egg even if the egg is not fertilized, right?
That's
so
true.
So maybe that's dragons true. Do the same.
And they don't feel very precious about them.
Right. And they're like completely free range. They live in the environment that they want to live in.
Free range dragons.
So they're okay with it.
I see. We're moving on for the sake of everyone,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. Right. The dragons are happy. We've established that.
Yeah. Well, some of them aren't. Some of them are angry. Angry dragons. Some of them are mean.
That's
mean
true.
Dragons.
Much like previous Wingspan. These dragons will let you store stuff on them, be it eggs or cards or resources, which are then at the end of the game converted into points. However, unlike previous Wingspan, there's a few more interesting systems that are happening here. So first of all, playing these cave cards so that you can play a dragon will net you one-time effects. They can be particularly desirable. And introducing this extra deck of effects lets you engineer more interesting, like, combinatorial power to kind of set your engine up and get it off the ground. The second thing that happens is that the dragons themselves have been reworked somewhat from the birds. There are now definitely more of a variety of different effects than there were before. I rewatched our review of Wingspan to catch up on what our big criticism points were. And one of them was that there are a lot of effects just that repeat over and over and over and over through the cards.
Mm.
And they refer to a lot of abstract information. So, like, nest type, wingspan size, you know, whether this is an angry bird or, you know, like vultures, you know, like, because they were like carnivores. I can't remember what it was, right? But there's a lot of abstract information on the cards, and a lot of the card effects just kind of bounced off of them. And there were a lot of repeating effects. They just said, like, tuck a card under this, tuck a card under this, tuck a card under this, right? There's like 20 cards that say, tuck a card under this, right? And it wasn't particularly exciting. So a lot of the same effects are in play here. But the way their reincarnations on cards appear are more varied and more conditional to create a more sort of combinatorial feel. This is definitely a more advanced game than Wingspan. And I think this is probably a great pickup for someone who has been playing Wingspan a lot and still likes it and enjoys it, but wants it as that sort of second step into, like, hey, what more is there, you know, in the similar vein, but, like, you know, kind of still familiar within that realm of Wingspan. So this is definitely very familiar, but you have to think a lot more about how you're combining these cards. And I have to say, this to me is a positive addition, because I found Wingspan too abstract, you know?
Okay.
I found the effects too similar and too rote and too kind of leaning on abstract information. There is still that here. For example, at the end of every round, you will score for arbitrary conditions, like how many playful dragons do you have, right? Mm. And playful is just a tag. And there is like four different tags. Like you said, there's angry or playful or
small.
Or small or large. Yeah, there's the size, right?
Mm.
There's also, on top of their size, there's something called hatchling. Right, which is the smallest size, right? And they all have the same effect, but the way it transpires combines with different cards in different ways, because you can feed the hatchlings resources, and every time you feed them a resource, something, if you feed them the right resource, something nice happens. But then if you fed it the third resource, then a bonus effect happens. So there's a lot of, like, kind of combinatorial power, and even though all the hatchlings do the same thing effectively, because they slot themselves into different paths, they feel more varied than they should.
Yeah,
for some reason it doesn't feel repetitive, because, like, maybe this hatchling has the effect that you really want and that one doesn't, so you're like looking for the right hatchling.
You know, I do wonder if those, what you said, were arbitrary goals at the end of each round. I wonder if they are to make the game a little bit more interesting, because the most points are on the larger dragons as a rule, overall. So in theory, all you would want to collect is large dragons, and you'd want to gain all your resources, you know, and keep, sort of hoard your resources in order to just get all these large dragons out. And, you know, it would become a bit rote, I think.
It's also to foster interaction, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, oh, large, we all know we want large dragons. Mm. So, you know, if you want to get the large dragon, you maybe want to do the action that gets you a dragon rather than the action that you actually want to do, so that you get it first than another player, right?
Yeah, things like that. Or because maybe you want someone else to take that dragon because you want to see what else comes out, because maybe that's better for you, because then you're going for that goal. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it does change up the game. And I quite like the guild board as well, the way that kind of changed things up, where you move around the guild board.
That's a nice new addition,
and you get various different bonuses, small bonuses, like an egg or a milk or like a resource. Or if you hit a certain point, you will get to do a slightly bigger bonus. You'll get a slightly bigger bonus.
And the bonus is your choice as well, right? Like, you can go for like a really cool upgrade that gets your engine going, or like, a, you know, just flat points at the end of the game.
Yeah.
But they are limited. So if you don't go for the flat points now, will it be gone later, right?
Yeah.
So it felt a little bit more tactical in that way. And I like that, because it felt like, you know, it added just a little bit more interactivity, but in a way that I think, again, this is serving Wingspan fans, right? This is going, hey, this is what you feel familiar and comfortable with, but you know, there's just a little bit more tactility, maybe even a little edge of meanness, just a sous-sent of meanness, you know, in that tactility.
Why?
Well, again, because it's like, you know, oh, yeah, I'll take these 6 points and now you can't have them. You cannot, because I've already put my pip back.
Yeah, but that's, Yeah, I don't know. I think that's just the game. I'm not saying that was a mean thing.
No, I'm not saying it's mean, but like there's a little bit more of an edge is what I mean.
I guess, yeah, maybe. I like this a lot more than I liked Wingspan. I like the dragons. I'm not a huge dragon fan overall. Actually, I feel really sorry for dragons generally. In most fiction, like Smaug, you know, it gets to me. I don't know why, but dragons get to me a little bit. But I'm not a massive like dragon fan. But I like learning about the dragons. I wish that something like that had been in Wingspan, honestly, like a whole booklet of all the birds and what they did and what they were like. And I enjoy learning about that sort of stuff generally. So I also like that there was that the dice tower had been removed, that there wasn't that fiddle of chucking dice into a dice tower. That I did not miss that at all. And I also liked how there was not that strange plastic
tray for
tray
cards.
I hated that. I'm sorry, but I really, really did not like that. It was fiddly, it was sharp, and it broke easily, and I did not like that. So not having that, you know, it was much better. So I think the production is really good of this. It's very pleasing to look at. Everything works. Everything is clear.
The art is gorgeous again. It's very different. But it's gorgeous.
The iconography is clear. You know, nothing is confusing in that way. And I really appreciate that. I don't know whether I would recommend this over Wingspan if you've never played either of them.
I think as an introduction to, you know, tableau builders, I think this is pretty solid. I think this is good. You know, it's not my favorite genre, right? And strangely, I wouldn't compare this to Wingspan now. Because why compare it? They're essentially the same game. It's just, you know, this one's a little bit more complex.
Would you compare it to Raising Robots?
No. Raising Robots is taking the idea of Wingspan and adding a bunch of convolution, right? This is still as elegant as Wingspan, but it's just, you know, like...
There's a little bit more.
A little bit more. It feels meatier. It feels more interesting, right? It feels gamier. And that's good, right? I like that. I would compare it to Forest Shuffle now, because that to me is my gold standard now, you know, of these tableau builders, and especially for like an introduction to tableau builders, right? It's got that really nice, pleasant vibe, you know, and for me right now, that's the game of interest within that sphere, right? Yeah. Forest Shuffle is very lean, very quick, very cool. This is meatier and bigger. And
there's more to do.
But that's my one reservation about it, is the to do. Wingspan felt long for what it was already. And I wasn't the only person that criticized it for that. A lot of the times people will say, don't play Wingspan at 4 or 5. It's just too long, 2 or 3 or solo. You know, it's a quicker game. It feels the right length. Waiting for other people to AP their turns through, you know, can be long and excruciating. I think with more complicated effects, this issue is exacerbated to the point where... One of the things that I've noticed is that round one feels like setup. There are 4 rounds in the game, and round one really feels like extended setup. It feels like it could have been removed and replaced with some sort of a quick draft to, like, you know, make your board a little bit more variable. That's how that felt to me, right? If I started the game from round two with the board as it was after round one, I think I would have been a lot happier. There's not a lot that I've done in round one yet, because I played a couple of cards or whatever, right? So it's not like much more to track. It just feels like a slightly more asymmetric start, right? And that first round took some time.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you though, because I quite like how it just sort of slid you into the game like that. I don't know if... I think it would have taken something away from it if it had just been part of the setup. Like, okay, you draw a random dragon or whatever and put it in your cave and that's the dragon you start with or whatever. I don't know, is that the kind of thing you meant?
I
don't think I would have enjoyed that as much. I liked having that introduction of, because I haven't played Wingspan for a long time and so I didn't remember necessarily how to play it, having that okay, these are the dragons, these are the ones in your hand, but you need cave tiles first, this is what you've got. And choosing, being able to choose from dragons and caves, and looking at the starting resources that you would get from putting those cave tiles down. Sorry, not starting resources, looking at the resources that you would get from putting those cave tiles down and how they interacted with the dragon cards that you had. There was some decision there. And I understand what you mean, that it was quite slow at the beginning. But I think that was only because we didn't quite have a goal in mind. But it does give you a little bit of a goal because...
It does, right. But it still feels like extended setup to me. I don't know. I just wish that part of the game went quicker, because I was stuck making decisions, but the decisions I was making were not particularly interesting. Yeah.
I understand.
And then once round two hit, I was like, oh, okay, no, this is interesting, right? I am having fun now. I'm starting to trigger things and they're starting to combine, you know. That's where the game started to come alive, and then it really came alive in round three and four. So... I don't know. Round one feels like a dud to me. I'm sorry. And I guess not everyone will feel the same way.
I did not.
But maybe there can be a variant for, you know, like a sped up setup, like a sped up game where you just start from round two with like some sort of a draft of cards or what. I don't know. Maybe
also,
it's possible.
We've only played it at two, so I can only speak from that. Happening at two, maybe in a four-player game that would be a lot more arduous.
Yeah, but again, people already say just don't play it with four, and I think as much as that was true for Wingspan, it's definitely more true for Wormspan. A couple of notes on the setting. So when I saw the announcement for Wormspan, my gut knee-jerk reaction, and I apologize for this, was like, is this an April Fool's joke, right? Because it's like, it feels very derivative, I think, initially. But then as soon as I said that, I was like, no, wait, no, right? Like, no, this makes sense, right? This is neat. And like I said at the beginning of the segment, you know, you can't beat Wingspan. You follow it up with something more esoteric that hopefully finds its own niche and its own love and its own kind of maybe smaller circle, right, of appreciators, enthusiasts, and fans, right? But I feel double bad for that knee-jerk reaction now, because apparently a lot of people went like, well, this doesn't need to exist. Why does it need to exist? Why not? Like,
I saw
what?
That. Yeah, I saw that.
You know? So yeah, I don't know. I kind of wanted to lay my cards on the table that I did too have this initial knee-jerk reaction, like, you know, but like, it took me a second to examine my own feelings and prejudices and wait, no, wait, why not? So there is that. Having said all of that, I would have preferred not dragons. I would have preferred, like, I don't know.
Well, we were saying, like, what it needs to have eggs if it's going to follow along the same line as Wingspan.
That's one of the, you know, signature components.
It, right?
Yeah.
It's got to have eggs. So what else has eggs? And I was like, well, you know, bugs have eggs. There are like slugs and
imagine a game about creepy crawlies, lots of little bugs. It'd be so cool. Spiders, beetles, worms.
Yeah.
They could have even called it Wormspan.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
That would have been so amazing.
Snail-span.
Having said that, worms don't lay eggs.
Do they not?
No, what do they do?
I thought worms laid eggs.
Do they lay eggs? I'm sorry, I'm showing my ignorance.
I mean, slugs and snails.
In Soviet school,
yeah,
I was taught that they reproduce by like splitting up into multiple worms or something. Is that wrong?
I mean,
am I showing my utter ignorance?
No. So I think what you're thinking of is if you chop a worm in half.
Yes.
Some types of worm can regenerate.
Right.
Part of their body.
Uh-huh.
Right. So, but it's based on lots of different things. It's not like if you go into the garden, chop a worm in half, they're going to be fine. They're just going to be two worms. It's based on a lot of different things. But certainly slugs and snails have eggs. And I think worms have too.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. Anyway, I misspoke about worm
like,
eggs.
Ants have eggs as
ants
well.
Ants have eggs, yeah.
There's loads of different things
that
have eggs.
And then we thought of another thing that has eggs, that has a whole biosphere. Marine life, right?
Oh,
like
fish.
Octopuses, fish, right? Imagine a game about like marine. Oh, it would be so beautiful as well, because clearly this team knows, you know, Stonemaier, you know, like, hires the right artists for Wingspan and for Wormspan as well, right?
We looked up mammals as well that, like, but I can't remember the name of them, the mammals that also lay eggs,
which are not marsupial, so like echidnas and platypi, right? Yeah,
but they're called something which I can't remember the name of, but
there's not enough of those.
There's not enough of them to fill out a whole game, but there are certainly other things that lay eggs. So I'm looking forward to like bug span and stuff coming in the future.
Octopus span, please. It's like so obvious.
C-span,
right? Yeah. Anyway, I think personally I would prefer that more, but I'll take Wormspan. It was an enjoyable game. It reminded me why Wingspan was so popular.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not much of a change. It is a little meatier. If you didn't like Wingspan, I mean, you know. But if you enjoyed it, I think there's a little bit more to rediscover here. It was nice. I liked it. I want to play more of it and explore more of it.
One last email. Which
there will never be emails after this anymore.
One last email in this episode.
Oh, phew. I like the emails.
Which sort of talks a little bit about Wormspan. It's on that kind of subject. Ooh. But they wrote in after our discussion on Age of Innovation and Raising Robots. So Jaron says, I think that both Age of Innovation and Raising Robots are great examples of what I call the best most problem. It's the same problem that you sometimes see in film awards, where the award for best editing usually goes to the film with the most editing, and the same for best actor and actress, best costume design, and many others. It's a problem of quantity and quality, and one that is also very prevalent in board games. For some reason, maybe my brain is broken, I always default to pizza analogies. Adding more toppings to a pizza does not necessarily make it better, and yet people will throw as many as they can and call it supreme, as if it's somehow better for having more toppings. The true supreme pizza is one made skillfully from the best possible ingredients and with intentionally chosen flavours, not simply one that has pepperoni and olives and peppers and everything else on the menu. This pattern of refinement by addition is troubling to me in a hobby with such high levels of consumption and cost. I haven't been around here for all that long, but it seems to me like this is a trend. Just in the last year or so, we've had Age of Innovation, Frosthaven, Great Western Trail, New Zealand, Dune Imperium Uprising, Sleeping Gods, Distant Skies, Wormspan, and I'm sure many other new releases that demonstrate this approach. I wish designers would try and solve problems in their games by retweaking and removing, not just adding on more toppings. I want the industry and gaming as a hobby in general to move away from excess and keep games affordable, approachable, and sustainable.
Jaron, I'm sending you a high five right now through the airwaves. Just my hand is up. If you raise your hand and then move it towards the screen, but not too fast because don't break the screen, or whatever device you're listening through, just move it on 3, 2, 1. There we go. That's a high five through the airwaves. I agree with everything. And pizza is a great analogy because I'm a big enthusiast of pizza. You know this, Elaine.
I do.
I make pizza many a time. I made it in many different ways.
And you tweak it.
I tweak it all the time. I made pizza in the smoker even. And it was
smoky.
Come on, say delicious.
Delicious, sorry.
Was it not, though?
It was great, yeah.
Yeah, that smoky flavor. Oh, yeah. That was really good. Right? And I love different kinds of pizza as well. I love pan pizza. I love Neapolitan style pizza. I've never had New York pizza because I've never been to New York, and apparently you can't. But you get my point. I made an equivalent of that, right, at home. And the one big trend, and this is all because of, you know, platforms like TikTok and whatever, right? Right now in pizza is a gigantic amount of pepperoni, right?
Really?
Like pepperoni so much you have to stack it vertically because otherwise it doesn't fit. Because it looks so good in a TikTok or an Instagram clip, right? Right? Like, whoa, look at the amount. It's disgusting if you eat that. Like it's just pepperoni fat dripping down your mouth. And there, I'm not gonna say that that's bad. I'm just gonna say, how much of that are you actually gonna enjoy? You know? Like,
You might as well just eat the pepperoni without the bread.
Right? Is that nice? Not very much, is it?
I mean, sometimes I do just eat a slice of ham or whatever. Or
it's not good, though, is it? Right? You don't want to have that by yourself. Like, how much of that are you going to eat? How much just plain chicken can you eat? It's not that good. Anyway, I love pizza. I'm a great appreciator of pizza. And pizza has been ruined by social media, you know? But like you say, you know, you just kind of want to, you know, take it down, tweak it, you know, like improve the bits that need improving rather than adding more. And I completely agree with that. I think Wormspan does that well, though. I have to say, I think it took the same base formula and just applied the right touches in some places, not in all places, because it's still long. It's still a lot between turns. And, you know, that round one now feels even longer because of the cave cards and whatnot. So that hasn't been improved. But nice little touches, you know. So I thought that was good. But yeah, Raising Robots was definitely just like Wingspan, but more effects, more game, more stuff, more resources, more everything. And now just sit there and account for everything. And I didn't enjoy that as much, and I don't think it improved on Wingspan in the way that it wanted to.
Efka, what's on the bonus episode this week, and where can people find it?
They can find it on patreon.com/nopunincluded by becoming a subscriber to our Patreon, where you will give us a bit of money every month, and you'll get bonus episode with more game coverage. Just like this episode, but like more games, right, that are covered on the bonus episode. And you give us some money every month and you get that. So that's our Patreon. You'll be supporting us. We're working for more things to go on the Patreon as well that will be exclusive to it. So stick around for that later down the line. On the bonus episode, we will be discussing Bloodstones by Martin Wallace. I have thoughts and feelings about that game. And Battle of Versailles, which is a cool two-player tug-of-war game set in the Battle of Versailles, which is not at all a war battle, but a fashion battle.
Finally, what is the game of this episode?
It's Wormspan. I mean, I think we both have our reservations for Seven Citadel, but Wormspan was a nice, pleasant time. And with that, why don't you say goodbye, Elaine?
Goodbye, Elaine.
Goodbye, Elaine.